You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. As demands for quality publications increase, the pressure to create premium content has only become more ferocious for any aspiring publisher. So, in an age where media can feel so disposable, how do you create something worth keeping? What's the secret to instilling that special feeling of sentimental value in a print publication? That's all coming up today on The Stack. On today's show, it's that time of the year where special end-of-year editions start popping up on newsstands all over the world. We'll open the covers on how to create that very special issue.
It's like media Darwinism, you've just got to evolve and be tougher and stronger.
Also ahead, we'll hear about a Portuguese title that refreshes its entire look with every issue.
We are trying to fight against the centrality of Portugal. It's the mission part of Gerador, and we are everywhere. But we don't sell everywhere.
Plus, we'll check in with a highlight from last week's FIP World Congress in Toronto. All that coming up on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack, Ben Ryland with you this week, as we take a look at the value of the physical object. And if that sounds like a slightly elusive topic, let me put it to you this way. Have you ever noticed someone reading a classic novel on a tablet while you've been on the train or on the bus, perhaps, and wondered how their bookshelves at home must look? Rather sparse, one might imagine. Well, a new event taking place here in London aims to take our focus away from the paradox of information overload online and celebrate the value of the physical object, whether it be books, magazines, records, or cassettes. Ben Freeman is one of the founders behind Future Artifacts, and he joins me here at Midori House. Ben, welcome. Also, while I'm no stranger to collecting the odd print volume here and there, I'm sure my next guest has plenty to teach me. He's the founder of the Hyman Archive, which is officially the largest collection of magazines. And he's also a DJ and broadcaster, among other things. James Hyman, welcome to The Stack. Well, as we said, it's about that time of year when we start seeing many publishers release their end-of-year editions, so we'll spend today talking about the concept of the special edition, and, more broadly, how publishers create something that instills that feeling of sentimental value in the printed product. Ben, I wanted to talk to you some more about Future Artifacts soon, but first, James, I think we need to hear about how that largest collection of magazines actually looks.
Well, if anyone wants to come down to the stockroom, where it's now stored in Woolwich, please make an appointment. You can have a look at it there. But it's about 80,000 magazines, 3,000 different publications, and it's in a beautiful media storage place.
So what was it that spurred you on to really decide to create what has become the largest collection?
Well, I always found magazines useful in whatever I did in my work as a scriptwriter at MTV, as a radio DJ on XFM, or any programs that I was producing or presenting for TV. Magazines, before the internet, really were the internet. They gave you your information source. And to really get good information, you looked in the magazines. And I did a lot of research, a lot of interviews, and I needed those magazines for that. So I never wanted to throw them away. I valued them. I treasured them. I saw the amount of effort and work that went into a magazine. So I collected, and in 2011, I archived them all with Tory Turk, and then it got into the Guinness Book of Records.
I think the way that you approach that is quite ahead of its time, I guess you could say, because what I really wanted to focus on with today's show was this concept of magazines being something that you do keep, and not just magazines, but the printed volume across all aspects, whether that be a book, a magazine, or even the album artwork that might come with a record. So I think it's interesting that you were really looking at magazines in that respect many, many years ago, because really one might argue that that's really not what magazines were originally supposed to be, were they?
True. What I would say is what is contained in those magazines is you have the best photographers, the best authors, the best illustrators. They're valuable. There's a lot of effort that went into that physical product, the design, the typeface, the content itself. Digital, I'm not anti-digital, but it's very easy. Just quickly do a tweet, do a this, do that, and it's done and it's there. those artifacts, that content inside that magazine is valuable, be it the information or just the actual design and feel and look of a magazine.
Now, Ben, Future Artifacts, I mean, first of all, we should probably just get you to explain what the idea behind Future Artifacts actually is, because I understand that it really does play into that whole concept of wanting to rediscover the value of the physical object, magazines being, of course, one of them.
Yeah, I think what's happened over the last, I mean, I've been working in this industry for about 10 years, and I grew up with magazines as well. You know, magazines for me in the late 80s, early 90s were a window on the world, and, you know, books, magazines and vinyl and posters were just, you know, they were magical things. And I think it's quite easy to be blasé about that stuff now because we're so saturated with information, everything's so accessible. But that stuff was completely key to my, you know, formative years. And Future Artifacts is... it's about the physicality of the object. I think what's happened, people didn't really know what was going to happen with the music industry or the publishing industry. And now I think we're seeing what is happening. And it's not about, you know, there's been what I think is a very boring argument for years about is print dead, isn't print dead, you know, and it's, to me, it's irrelevant because print's just, it's a process. And of course it's not dead, but it's just changed. You know, the landscape of the music industry changed a while before the publishing industry because it's more dynamic and it's run by younger people. And we're seeing the same thing in the publishing industry, but it's not that, you know, people don't appreciate physicality anymore. It's that they don't need that to get their information. Or if they do, they absorb the information in a different way. You know, it's a slower type of consumption.
I think I would say that the difference is, of course, yes, you can download something to your phone, whether it is an article that you're reading about the news that's happening now, or if it's a song. And maybe that will be disposable and it will go away and you won't think about it again. But there is still that inbuilt human instinct that you really do treasure something, you love something. And when that's the reason that you're consuming that medium, you end up just wanting more and more and more. And anything that's digital is not going to give that to you, is it?
Yeah, for us, that's the core of Future Artifacts, is that, you know, it's, we're basic creatures. And I think, you know, anything that I connect to, I need to physically connect to as well. And I think, you know, there's one function to just flicking through things on my phone. You know, it's just fulfilling a basic purpose. But, you know, to really emotionally attach to something, I think we need to be able to touch and literally feel it.
So the timing of today's show is quite fortunate because it is that time of year now when we start to see many publishers release their end of year editions, the Christmas editions, those bumper issues that are designed to be the keepsake and the one that really sums up the year and maybe provides a window for future generations to look back at this particular magazine or series of books and say that really sums up what 2015 was. Much of the industry has caught on to that modern yearning by readers to really engage with their printed content. They don't just want to consume it, they want to treasure it and keep it. What is it about a magazine or book that really makes you want to keep it, James?
There are two things. I mean, you're obviously asking a guy who, will, once a magazine comes out, I'm going to collect it till that magazine dies. But for me, it is the content of what's in it, the effort that's gone into it. I mean, I'm holding one here called Little White Lies.
Now, one of my favourites,
yeah,
definitely.
You ask about special editions. To me, every issue of this is a special edition, simply because it invigorates me about film every time I read it. They put themes to each issue, you know, whether it's horror, midnight movies, a director. They always ask everyone why a film appeals to them. But it's just so, you can really, really, it jumps off the pages, the design. They did a whole thing about 50 films in the 70s. They got a person to choose a film, and then they did an illustration unique to each of those films. It's that effort. It's what you like. It really, you know, anything you like, whether it's film, fashion, television, sport, if there was a magazine for it and you really like that content, to me, I would collect that magazine.
The other interesting thing just on that subject is that I don't think there are fewer interesting magazines now than there were 20 years ago. In fact, there's a magazine shop in Shoreditch by Spitalfields Market, and it's absolutely stuffed with beautiful new magazines coming out. You know, when people set out to make a magazine now, they know they're not doing it for the sake of it. You know, it's not just a thing to push content out, so they're putting effort in where they probably wouldn't have had to 20 years ago to justify it. So I'm seeing loads and loads of really beautiful new magazines coming out all the time now. They don't necessarily last that long because of the marketplace, but people are definitely making an effort.
I get anxiety. I went into Foyles on the way here today and I saw all the new magazines. I go through to Wardour Street. You know, they're a virus. They're spreading.
A good kind of virus, I would definitely argue. We'll hear more from James Hyman and Ben Freeman a little later on the show. For now, though, we'll take a very short break. And when we come back, we'll hear about a Portuguese magazine that aims to release a special issue every issue. That's next on The Stack. You're with The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. My guests today are James Hyman, the man behind the Hyman Archive, and Ben Freeman, one of the founders of Future Artifacts, taking place right now here in London. Ben, it's into its second day. Let's have a bit of a chat about Future Artifacts, actually. How did it come about, and what can we actually expect to see there?
Future Artifacts came about because my business partner, Dino, Joe, and I, I've been going to a lot of publishing fairs for years with my other business, Ditto Press. It started off as an idea to just make a vibrant, dynamic, fun and engaging publishing fair, because for a publisher, it's a great place to be. You know, you get much more of your cover price when you sell something. You meet the public and, you know, you have a good time. And there are more and more of them cropping up, but we just thought we'll develop the ultimate good publishing fair. And that's developed into just over the 2 years we were working on it, it became apparent that rather than focusing on arts publishing or record labels or whatever, the marketplace has changed and it doesn't need to be separated anymore. So we brought together, you know, there are as many record labels as there are arts publishers and tech companies involved in Future Artifacts. And the focus is on the object and the craft rather than people who like art books or people who like records or people who like cassettes. You know, it doesn't divide them anymore.
So that's Future Artifacts happening this weekend at Shoreditch Studios here in London. We'll hear from Ben and James again a little later in the show and perhaps flick through some of their favourite print titles too. But first, let's turn our attention to a small quarterly Portuguese magazine. With a print run of just 5,000, it's been making waves in a country that has plenty of culture, but few resources to share it. Simon Tarek sat down for a chat with the team behind Gerador, or Generator, which is aiming to cover all of Portuguese culture, from major theatre events to niche gastronomy, in a way that also combines parallel events and smart branding too.
More or less.
The small office belonging to Gerador magazine, off the leafy Placidas Flores in Lisbon, feels like a cosy shared flat. Co-founder and editor Pedro Saavedra and his friendly team have been here for more than a year now, working on a quarterly publication that has ambitions beyond its 5,000 distributed copies, using the magazine as a platform for cultural events, social networking, and also a growing branding agency. Gerador, or Generator, began with a simple concept: to bring all of Portuguese culture to all of Portugal. After Pedro, along with cohorts Miguel Bica and Tiago Sigurelio, worked together on a cultural event in Lisbon, they decided to continue to work together as a team.
We decided to move forward and try to make a project about Portuguese culture in a moment where that for us is very important, not because we want to talk about Portuguese culture against other cultures, but because we think that Portuguese people need to have more access to Portuguese culture. So it's a project of identity that tries to decodify what is happening in culture to people that are curious, but they are not frequent spectators. They don't normally go to see things. That's why we started with a magazine, which was the first project that we launched. It's a quarterly magazine that has a different theme, as I was saying, and a different designer. We didn't have any kind of experience as editing books or magazines or whatever. We just started to read other magazines, including Monocle, of course, and we started to think, what should we do? And how can we create an object that it's also appealing and it's something that you want to read but you also want to keep? We want to work optimism and self-esteem and to show people that in so many areas we are doing amazing things, because creativity is everywhere and economics doesn't change that. So every time that you make a traditional food at your place, you're producing culture. So that's why we wanted to start with the magazine, also being provocative. Like, is this a magazine? Is this a book? Oh, it has images. There are people doing comics in Portugal. I didn't know that. Oh, but there's a guy writing a romance, but it was started by another guy. Oh, they work together, writers. This guy that I know from the TV is talking here about what he likes to eat at home. So in a way, we are trying to create a disturbance. And little by little, we can also try to provoke people so that they start to know something inside a magazine. Then they can go to Trampoline and watch it live. Or they can even get the feeling, oh, I should go more to the theater.
Looking through the last five issues, it is clear that Gerador is open to new forms of visual design, with playful illustrations and cross-pollinated ideas across the pages. With new superheroes being drawn by young artists, to interviews between an old-school Portuguese singer and a contemporary hip-hop musician, to the growing agenda in which their partner brands are coherently represented, this small A5 publication, chock-full of stories, interviews and artwork, is making crucial connections, as Tiago explains.
We are trying to fight against the centrality of Portugal. It's the mission part of Gerador, and we are everywhere, but we don't sell everywhere. We are still very young. We know that we need to be here for quite some time so that the magazine will be consistent and the initiatives will be consistent. And meanwhile, or forever, I don't know, we have to do this to get really near the brands and answer some of their necessities in a way that the common agency does not, because the artists are different. We do not work with the common designer or the common copywriter, so it's a little bit different. Also, we always answer in a way that's coherent with what we do.
In a way, we are achieving this point where we are getting so much feedback that more and more we feel that the magazine is approaching what people want to read, or areas that we still haven't talked about, or ways that we haven't tried. But one of the conclusions that we have is the kind of speech that we have, which is, it's a very informal speech with sense of humor, that we try not to be serious even with ourselves, it's working. So people more and more asked us to buy the magazines, or they try to make us questions, or they even send us ideas. One of the amazing things is from number one, that we started with a bunch of people that we knew and asked them things. From number four, the percentage of people that started with an email saying, hey Pedro, I have an idea, and are already here, it's more than 50%. So our main goal is to keep ourselves small in that point of view.
Simon Tarek there, meeting the team behind Gerador magazine. James, the News Weekly. Now, I'm talking Newsweek and Time magazine and so on. They are, of course, by their nature, not items that were intended to be kept. But I suppose, perhaps a little bit paradoxically, they've become windows into a particular era and in some cases have evolved into keepsakes. And yet I was chatting to our Toronto correspondent Chris Frey before the show, and he told me about how a lot of these big publishers of the prestigious weeklies don't really consider themselves magazine companies anymore. They often prefer the term content company. James, what are your thoughts on how some of these traditionally very topical publications can evolve into something a little more timeless?
It's like media Darwinism. You've just got to evolve and be tougher and stronger. You look at the great title like The New Yorker, some of the best journalism in the world. What do they have on their website? Videos about the cartoons in there, about the content. Or a magazine has got to have a website, possibly a podcast, radio spin-off. It can't just exist. Well, it can. You can have substantial print magazines and that's it. But they have to diversify into social media, video, websites, and most of them do.
Well, as we mentioned a little earlier in the show, the 40th FIP World Congress took place in Toronto last week. It's the largest magazine media event in the world, and this year's proceedings attracted some of the industry's top talent who presented their ideas on how the media can continue to innovate. As we've been discussing today, it's often the publications with a long, prestigious history that face the biggest challenges when it comes to the pressures of modernising their operation. National Geographic spent 127 years as a non-profit publication, and since the early 1900s, it's attracted a global reputation, of course, for its striking use of photography. But it seems some big challenges might be in store for the magazine in the near future. Last month, Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox expanded its relationship with the publication in a deal worth about $725 million. Yulia Boyle is a Senior Vice President for International Publishing at National Geographic Society, and our Toronto correspondent Chris Frey caught up with her at FIP.
This is a great opportunity for us to meet with our licensing partners, because we publish in 80 countries throughout the world, and a lot of them come here. So in addition to hearing them speak about innovations that they are launching in their countries, where we could sort of piggyback on or learn from, we also take the time to do meetings and launch new products or conceptualize new products with them.
from talking to your peers this time around? Are there certain themes that are emerging or certain developments in the industry that you're taking note of?
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely advertising that does not work in traditional formats is something that I heard a lot today and yesterday. We have to find other ways to finance, to monetize our product and stay true to our editorial integrity. At the same time, advertising as it's known in a sort of a display ad page does not work anymore. So it's scary. At the same time, there's a great opportunity to look for other ways. And that's what I'm here to learn, actually, what our others are doing. And this creativity panel today was fantastic in that regard. Also, there's a lot of discussion about culture, about organizational culture, which I heard all the time, pretty much, in the last 2 days. And this is wonderful. I mean, having a culture of collaborative thinking, of involving a lot of young people with completely no experience, but looking at problems from a very new perspective, I think it's lovely to hear all of that that's coming out from Time Inc., from Rodale, from many other publishers. I heard talk about culture.
There does seem to be, maybe mm-hmm. obsession is a strong word, but now mm-hmm. getting a sense of the millennial generation mm-hmm. and how do we involve them in mm-hmm. the creative process for our publications?
We do, for sure. I mean, we, of course, you know, there are talented people of all ages and everywhere, but digital natives are incredible. I mean, they can do things that I cannot do anymore. So we are looking at them for innovation. We are employing a lot of very young digital editors across all of our platforms and across all of the ways we tell story. We want their opinions and we want their expertise, technical expertise.
I'd like to ask you again the question that occurred in uh-huh. the actual Congress yes. at the end of your talk, because yes. it is such a highly regarded brand, and mm-hmm. once we mix it up with sponsored content, native mm-hmm. advertising, feel free to just sort of complete uh-huh. to repeat the mm-hmm. answer you gave. Mm-hmm. But can you go into a little bit of detail then how you yes. manage those relationships mm-hmm. in your editorial integrity?
As I said during the Congress, we are not allowing our client to preview any of our editorial work. We're not even allowing them to give direction. I mean, we are very, very strict about it, and that's how we are able to keep the brand intact, and we intend to keep it that way. If a client wants to send us to Kenya, which they've done recently, we take the top photographer and the top travel storyteller that has multiple millions of audience already. So first of all, the person is well known, and he's a journalist or she's a journalist, and they cover it as a journalist. It's a journalistic exercise. We tell everything that we see that our travelers to that country should know. If there's a danger, if there is like not a secure hotel, we will tell about that. So this is how we are maintaining that balance. And if Kenyan Tourism Board or any other tourism board wants to have visually stunning, incredible storytelling about their destination, they also should be able to perhaps work a little more on infrastructure and make some improvements. And we give some suggestions on that as well. So that's how we try to accomplish that part.
Chris Frey there chatting to National Geographic's Yulia Boyle. Now, gentlemen, we're nearly out of time, but let's have a quick look at the titles that you've both brought in. James, first, I can see Darth Vader staring out at me over there.
The reason I brought, I mean, you said to bring in some special edition stuff, why you would keep something. Well, this was the June 2005 issue of Empire. Apparently, this cover cost $250,000 to produce, and it was one of the PPA magazine's top covers of the century. Basically, it was a breathing Darth Vader. You open it. I hate to be anticlimactic, because this is a spare copy. He doesn't breathe, but we've got a nice water effect there, that, which is not really Darth Vader. But yeah, they had to get clearance from George Lucas. But, you know, that was something. If you're a Star Wars geek, you're going to keep that.
Wow.
I assume. It, you know, you open it and yeah. it breathes Darth Vader style. A couple of other quick ones. I mean, again, just random, crazy future artifacts, maybe past, present artifacts. Nice magazine, which is just a slab of wood. I even bought three of them.
So these are actually, I was just thinking,
this was a magazine.
They look awfully like wood. It's because they are actually wood.
They are wood, and it is a magazine that's a piece of wood. But I like that just kind of abstract vibe. This was a girl called Rachel Stewart. When she was at Goldsmiths, she produced a magazine called Engaged.
Oh my, this is...
Each issue was a different artifact. So issue one was a T-shirt, issue two was a poster, issue three was a CD-ROM, and I, in my hand, have issue five, which was a VHS video.
Can I please just... I need to have a look at this. It is actually just a VHS tape.
It's a VHS tape.
And you've kept it inside a
Indeed.
Bag here.
Yeah.
So how is this consumed? Do you have to put it inside...
You put it in a video.
Yeah, and yeah. what happens?
I have never watched it. Could be like The Ring or one of those. I can't remember that horror film where you put the video where you can get
yes,
like haunted.
Of course.
And one other, I mean, I want to just give one other shout out, which actually, I guess, combines future artifacts too, was, you remember King of Limbs, Radiohead's album. Basically, this guy, Stanley Donwood, he did an amazing newspaper edition of it. He made it a collector's item that you couldn't collect, because as soon as you put this, it was like a newspaper in a certain plastic. The sunlight would just degrade the plastic, and the newspaper's obviously going to crumple. And, you know, I love that, again, pushing the boundary of something that's a collector's item, but you can't really collect it, showing the beauty of that physicality.
Frustrates collectors, yeah, all over the world.
Exactly, exactly. Lock it in a box.
Ben, you've got your own interesting little pile over there. Can we have a quick look through some of the titles that you've brought in?
Yeah, sure. My other business is called Ditto Press, and I've just brought in some of the things that we produce there. This is the latest book we produce, which is called Metallon. I art directed and designed this with a lady called Emma Hammar, who's an archivist. It's all based on the photo archive from a defunct metal factory in Sweden. So it was running for about 150 years. It shut down in the 90s. And they had a huge photo archive in Västerås in Sweden. So she became obsessed with it and spent years just kind of in this archive going through it. And then her and I went through, you know, there's a good kind of 50, 60,000 images. And we found these photos of oxidizing copper. They're films, actually, 16mm films. And we overlaid them with stress tests on metals to make these kind of very abstract.
That's absolutely fascinating, actually. So you've gone through this quite scientific and technical process to create what is basically visual art.
It's also printed. Instead of CMYK, we replaced which is the normal print process, cyan, magenta, yellow and black. We replaced the magenta with fluorescent pink and the yellow with fluorescent yellow. So if you see it in sunlight, it's incredibly poppy. And then we printed some bits in silver. The cover's got a kind of hologram embossing on it, and the cover's iridescent. So with this particular project, I just went nuts on every conceivable kind of, you know, print process methodology, being weird for the sake of it.
And perhaps just enough time for one more.
I thought it would be good to talk about this on the subject of archives, because this is kind of an archive in reverse. This is a collection of very rare fanzines and bits of print material from skinhead subculture over about 45 years. I think, you know, skinhead started in about 1967. But this is very rare, very, you know, most of these are zines and posters, which, you know, there were probably 50 copies of. And then we've printed it and published it in this deliberately kind of obnoxiously luxurious book. It's got a gold cover, a massive kind of last resort crucified skinhead girl on the cover. And we designed the font with Jamie Reed, the art director at Dazed, worked with us on this and designed a custom font. And this is this is the most popular book we've done at Ditto. But it's got plenty of things like short pages and gold ink and, you know, three different print processes and all sorts of stuff.
That's beautifully presented.
But yeah, we took a deliberate choice to make it as far away from what you'd expect as possible, you know.
Brilliant. Sadly, we are out of time today. My thanks to our guests today, James Hyman from the Hyman Archive and Ben Freeman, co-founder of Future Artifacts, taking place this weekend here in London. And we should mention also that the Hyman Archive is undergoing a big project to digitise its library, making all the content searchable online. Head to hymanarchive.com for information on how you can support that initiative. A very big thanks also to our editor today, who was Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then of course you can always drop us a note over at info@monocle.com. And remember, we are of course back next Saturday at the same time, and you can always tune in again via monocle.com or iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.